Welcome back to the Plugged in LaPorte podcast, everyone. I'm Nate Laux, your guide to all the happenings, insights, and personal stories from LaPorte, Indiana. Thank you for allowing us into your homes, your cars, or wherever you're tuning in from. Today, we're releasing our fourth episode. Let me tell you, it's packed with conversations that I truly enjoyed having, and I'm excited to share them with you. And thanks to our incredible podcast partner, the LaPorte Economic Advancement Partnership, for their support. Find out more about LEAP and the incredible work they do at LaPortePartnership.com. I'm very excited about today's podcast. First, I have a conversation with State Representative Jim Pressel. We discuss the outcomes of the recently completed Indiana legislative session, including the achievements and challenges that lie ahead for upcoming legislative agendas. We also discuss potential ideas for improving the roads and routes in LaPorte. Obviously, many conversations about a potential corridor or a bypass around LaPorte. We discuss that as well. We also talk about some of the things that go into making an idea into a law. Next, I was thrilled to have the LaPorte Parks Superintendent Mark Schreiber join us. The growth of LaPorte's parks has been remarkable, not only in the size, but also in the range and the quality of programs offered to our community, plus the incredible trails that have been added in the last couple of years. This also includes the highly popular Lake Fest event that many LaPorte residents enjoyed. Mark discusses the plans for this upcoming summer and the trail and infrastructure improvements that the Parks Department is focusing on for the upcoming years. Now, each guest we have brings a unique perspective on how they are contributing to the vibrancy and resilience of LaPorte. Whether it's through legislative progress, enhancing shared spaces, or innovating in the local economy, today's conversations promise something for everyone. We like to say around here that our goal is to become curious, connected, and plugged in. So as we settle in for this episode, I encourage you to keep that tagline close to heart, because curiosity leads to learning, connections foster community, and together we stay plugged into the heartbeat of LaPorte. Before we begin, I'd like to make one final note. The Indiana primary election is quickly approaching on May 7th. Early voting has already begun. Voting is not just a right, it is a cornerstone of democracy, an action that reflects the voices of the past and shapes the future. For residents of LaPorte, Indiana, the upcoming primary is an opportunity to exercise this fundamental right. It's more than just marking a ballot. It's about expressing your views on the issues that directly impact your life, the issues that we talk about on the Plugged in LaPorte podcast. Your vote is a direct line to decision makers on matters such as local infrastructure projects and education reform, and whatever it is that you care deeply about. Despite its importance, though, we have historically seen lower turnouts in primaries, especially at the local and state levels. This is a trend that we have the power to change, starting right here in LaPorte. Each vote cast is a declaration that says, I care about my community and its future. It's an incredible privilege that many around the world still fight for. You may not believe that your vote counts or is significant, but in my experience, every big change starts with small steps. Local elections shape policies that directly affect our daily lives, sometimes even more than national elections. Our school board, the infrastructure projects in our city, and our property taxes are all influenced by the individuals we elect to represent us right here. So check your registration status, find your polling place, and if possible, familiarize yourself with the candidates and the issues that you care about. And more importantly, vote, please. All right, let's get started. First up, we have State Representative Jim Pressel on the Plugged in LaPorte podcast. Today, we're shifting our attention to the core of Indiana's legislative scene as we talk about the 2024 legislative session that just recently got over. Joining me in the studio is a well-known figure in our region and a longtime member of the State House, Representative Jim Pressel. With his tenure in District 20 starting in 2016, Representative Pressel will bring some experience and knowledge to our discussion, hopefully anyway, particularly in the significant roles on the Roads and Transportation Committee, the Elections and Apportionment Committee, and the Government and Regulatory Reform Committee. Representative Pressel has served on legislative committees addressing a wide range of issues, from infrastructure developments to ensuring the integrity of our electoral processes. So today we'll learn more about his journey, the important matters that shape the 2024 legislative session, and the upcoming priorities for Indiana as we continue to go as a state. Representative Pressel, welcome to the Plugged in LaPorte podcast. It's great to have you here today.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. And many people might not know that you and I have known each other since I was probably less tall than I am now.
Actually, I thought that's what we were going to talk about today was, yeah. You know, that when you would be at my house, there was fireworks stuff going on. And
that's absolutely
we're not going
true.
There.
Bonfires.
Absolutely.
Hay rides. And so, we're going to talk about the legislative session and what happened over the last couple of months. Now, I don't assume that all of our listeners understand how our government works, and it's actually always surprising and humbling to me to know that a lot of people don't. And so let's start off a little bit talking about, you have two types of what we call sessions in the government. Yeah. You have a short session and a long session. 2024 was what?
2024 was the short session. So and the reality of that is we don't do anything fiscally, right? So we tend not to even move policy that has dollars attached to it. That's all done in the long session. But the short session, typically, I explained this to somebody earlier today, because you're absolutely right. Most people don't follow it enough. And I don't blame them for that. So it's good to have a little education on it.
Most people are unlike me. They have lives.
True. Right. So we start typically January 1st. It's like the 3rd or the 4th. But if I just kind of throw out there, it's the 1st of January, and then it goes through March 14th was this year's statutory date. So we have to adjourn. We're a part-time General Assembly, so we have to adjourn on a date specific. And if we don't do that, that triggers a mechanism to where the governor may or may not call us back in for a special session. So this year we started a week late and we finished a week early. We got all of our work done. We didn't do anything with the budget. Now the budget is what we're going to do in a long session. So that'll be coming up in 25. The odd years are budget sessions. Those are a lot more in depth. We deal with our biannual budget. We set those numbers all up, and then we deal with different policies that will require line items in the budget, or an addition to a line item in the budget, or maybe a reduction in a line item in the budget, depending on what the policy is. And those will still start around that January 1st. But then we go to the end of April. Typically, it's April 29th, April 30th that we statutorily have to adjourn. So those are the two sessions.
And I want to talk a little bit about how legislation happens. Maybe people haven't watched Schoolhouse Rock lately, but you're a representative, obviously, an elected official here. You have an idea of something that you think would better your constituents. So you take these ideas down there. It obviously doesn't become law right away. So what is the process of going from legislative idea to the governor signs it into law?
Sure. Great question. I love talking about the process. So I think the process is pure. The process is fully vetted. I'll put that out there to begin with, right? It is a great process if you follow something all the way through. So I would tell you, starting with that idea, it may not even be my idea. It may be something that just came up in a conversation that a light bulb went off in my mind, right? Or something a constituent brought to me and said, hey, this has been a problem. Why don't you guys address it? And it may be something that nobody's ever really thought about, because nobody else is having that problem. So you have that idea, whether it be the legislator or a constituent that brought it to you. The process would look something like, I would put in a draft request, and then Legislative Services Agency, which the acronym is LSA. LSA is a group of attorneys that specialize in all different kinds of fields, right? So you may have a utilities attorney, you've got a transportation attorney, you've got local government attorneys, and they multitask, but typically they'll have two or three specialties. But they'll take that idea and they will draft up a piece of legislation, put it in the proper code site so that it fits, and I'll get it back after they're done with it. And then I'll have an opportunity to kind of read through it and go, well, this doesn't make sense to me, how the verbiage is, or maybe we should do this instead of that, right? And I give them these multiple changes. We're back and forth for over about a month, probably maybe 2 months.
And when is this started?
So I'll start doing that. I mean, we're April now. So in June, I'll start actually working with LSA on more complex stuff. Okay. And if it's something simple that comes to me, it may take like a month process. But a lot of the things that I work on are very complex, kind of down in the weeds. And for me, what I've learned over 8 years is you really need to think through the what if portion of it. So I like to get a good draft where I'm happy with it, and then I share it with stakeholders. So depending on what the issue is, it could be something that I give to law enforcement and say, what do you think about this? And they're the experts, right? The stakeholders are the experts. So they can give me that feedback, and then we can adapt. So it could take 6 months, might be 2 months. Then as soon as we go into session, we'll have a filing deadline. So there'll be a date that the Speaker of the House puts out, and it typically is like January 10th. So you have to have your bill filed before January 10th, or there is no more bills getting filed for that particular session.
You lost your chance to get that bill even heard.
It's done, right? Now, there could be a little bit of strategy in there. Maybe somebody else has a bill similar to yours that you just learned about. Maybe some things that are in your bill are not in that bill. So if you file the bill, then you have what's called bill pending. And I wouldn't be able to use that bill as an amendment to anything. So if I hold it, because I know there's something similar, and I talked to the author of the similar bill, we may be able to use part of my bill and amend it into his or hers. So there's a little bit of a strategy to it as well.
You want your greatest chance for the bill to get heard. Right?
Absolutely. It's all about getting the hearing. So there are so many bills that will get filed, like a typical long session. There's probably between 1,100 and 1,200 bills that get filed between the House and the Senate. This year, I think we were somewhere in the neighborhood of 750, maybe 800.
Because there's also a limit of how many you can bring.
There is. The House always has a limit. The Senate has just recently started a limit. So they used to have unlimited in a long session. So they could offer up 100 bills by one legislator, one senator. Now they're limited to 10 also. So I have a limit of 10 in a long session and a limit of 5 in a short session. So these bills all then get filed, right? And they get put out to assigned to the different committees. So I chair transportation, roads and transportation in the House. So I'll typically get 30 or 40 bills that'll come to my committee. Now it's up to the committee chairman then to look at that bill, go through it, maybe have conversations with the author and determine whether I'm going to give it a hearing or not. And some would say that's a lot of power for one individual to have.
Have you ever, no names, but have you ever had a representative get upset at you for not letting their bill get heard?
Multiple times. Okay. Multiple times in every session, right?
And have you ever gotten upset at another chair for not letting your bill get heard?
Absolutely. So, I mean, they're passionate, right? Yep. I worked on it for 6 months or I worked on it for 2 months. I've worked with stakeholders on it. And
it's genuinely up to that person whether or not.
It is up to the chairman of that committee to hear it or not. And typically, as a chairman, I will give words of wisdom, we'll call it, right? And I'll tell you what I don't like about it, or maybe what I do like, and things that need to be changed. So we may come up with an agreement that I hear the bill, but these are the changes that I expect to go into the bill or that will happen in committee in order for it to be a bill that I think that should come through transportation. So
at some point,
you
have to know, listen, the way this bill is written is not going to make it through, right? So
exactly.
If we waste our time talking about this bill that we know is DOA, but maybe if you change some things here, we might have a chance.
Exactly. Right? You know, a real good example of that, and we'll just pick on me, right? Yeah. So I've had bills that have gone on for 4 years. When I worked on distracted driving, no texting and driving, that took almost 5 years to get done. 4 years I carried that. And there was always a problem of sorts with it, something that somebody couldn't vote for or something that just wasn't quite right. So it does take a lot of time. I mean, I worked a lot with Julie West with Play for Jake Foundation. She was very successful her first year, and the second year she only got half of what we set out to do legislatively, and I'm sure we're coming back again this next year to add to that. So that's the chairman's job. They're the gatekeeper.
So then you get the bill heard if the chairman says, yeah, let's push this through to the committee, and then the committee's going to talk about it and decide whether or not they want to pass it through committee.
And they'll have the opportunity to amend it also, depending on what the topic is, what the issue, what the bill looks like. So we'll take testimony in committee. And something that somebody may say during that testimony may inspire an amendment. So we'll hold that bill over for a week, and we'll bring back an amendment to take care of this unforeseen circumstance that really nobody thought about. So that's part of that process that I say is really, really good, because so many people have the opportunity to affect that piece of legislation and bring in a certain expertise for the issue, right? Mm-hmm. So once it gets out of committee, we'll assume that we amended it in committee and now it's out. It goes to the floor and it's on second reading. So it's eligible for the whole body then to put an amendment on it. And you've got typically about 48 hours to read through these pieces of legislation that are going to be on second reading and draft an amendment for it.
If you've never watched this process happen, it's absolutely, and this is where I get the most patriotic, I think, because you have people from both sides of the aisle. asking questions of the sponsor that's sponsoring that bill, and asking what if this happens, and sometimes saying I just don't think this is the right language for this, and the tweaking of that happens, and sometimes the sponsor will say, I think, you know, yeah, that,
this is
I'm,
good
I'm willing
stuff,
to make
right?
that amendment. That's great. And then to go from there to, it passes, you know, to then, but it's still not a bill
It's not a law. It's not a law. It's not even eligible, right? So it gets through one chamber. It comes through the House because that's where we start. All the good bills are in the House. Just had to throw that in there.
Yeah.
So you get through third reading. You've had all these amendments. You've had the committee hearing. And the Senate's done the same thing with their Senate bills. And then we have what's called halftime. That's when the General Assembly will take about a four-day break. And the bills then switch houses. The Senate bills come to the House. House bills go to the Senate. And the whole process starts all over again. The Speaker will then assign bills to committees. And I'll get a whole new list of bills in transportation to take a look at. Now, they've already been through one chamber. So they've been through half of the system. So you'd think, you know, maybe we're going to hear all of them because they've all been vetted.
Is there like a constitutional, essentially where you have to, if a Senate bill comes to the House committee, do you have to hear that bill? Or
I do not.
Okay.
No, same rules apply. Yeah. It's up to the gatekeeper, the chairman of that committee. So it could be policy that, you know, I'm opposed to. It could be policy that the committee is opposed to. But I am the gatekeeper for all of those bills that get assigned to that committee, whether they're a House bill or they're a Senate bill.
So it has to go through the whole
process all over again. And typically, you know, I might hear 20% of the bills that come to me is probably a big number. So I get rid of more than I probably, some would say probably more than I should, right? It's just not ready for the prime time is what I would call it. So now I have senators mad at me because I wouldn't hear their bill. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I've worked out a negotiation and say, okay, I like where you're going and here we are. We're going to amend this and that's how it's going to move forward. And we start that whole process all over again, get it through the committee, get it amended if it needs it. It may come through there with no amendments whatsoever and goes to the second reading and no amendments there. Or maybe it did get amended. But I think what's really interesting is when you get through all of those bills, the House is in the Senate now, Senate bills are in the House. If you have one particular bill, Nate, that never was amended in the Senate, never was amended in the House, that bill goes directly to the governor's desk to be signed.
Oh, really? I did not know that. I know a lot of things about the government, but did not know that. So.
The key is the chambers, if the chambers both voted on the same language with no changes, then it goes directly to the governor's desk. If it gets through that both processes and there were changes made in either chamber that they didn't vote on, now it's eligible for three things. Conference committee, which is triggered by a dissent motion, and or a concurrence motion. So let's say I had a bill in the Senate, they amended it, and I said, okay, I'm good with your changes. This makes sense to me. Thank you for helping me out, making a great bill even greater. I can file a concurrence motion. That means I'm going to take that back to the House floor. We're going to talk about the changes, and then that body will then vote on the concurrence motion. You're not voting on the bill. You're only voting on the changes that were made, the difference. If it passes there, then it goes to the governor's desk. The Senate doesn't have to vote on it again because they made the changes. So if it does get voted down, then you go back to what's called conference committee. Conference committee is then made up of two members of the House, two members of the Senate. And we get together and we figure out, okay, how do we fix this? This is good policy, but we each don't like something about it, or we each want something more in it, right? So then you have a conference committee report that both chambers then vote on. And if it's successful in both chambers, then it goes to the governor's office for signature.
And this is what my favorite thing is, too, is the governor still has to sign it. And if he doesn't want to sign it, he doesn't have to sign it, right?
He does.
And you can overrule the governor, I think, right?
We can override a veto. Yeah,
but the governor can veto a bill. So the whole process to me is just fascinating because there's so many different checks and balances. It's hard to get a bill even heard. It's even harder to get a bill passed. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the 2024 legislative session. What were, I guess, the Speaker of the House or the House Majority Leader will kind of usually give priorities that are they want to see happen in each legislative session. What were the priorities that you heard before the session, if you remember them anyway, for 2024 that the legislator wanted to tackle?
You know, so the speaker set down what would be our priorities for the Republican caucus. We wanted to make sure that third graders can read, right? We need to address reading problems that are statewide, right?
That was a big
priority.
Do we have a problem with that in Indiana?
We do.
Okay.
We absolutely do. So that was actually one of the bills that got passed, and we'll probably wander into that on down the path here. But that was one of the things that the speaker set out and said, we're going to do this. We're going to clean up CTE stuff that we started working on for different pathways for kids to be able to go into a trade or go into something other than a four-year degree. And we've really kind of laid a foundation for it.
For those that might not know, CTE is, if you're thinking football, no, it's a career technical education.
Yes.
But yeah, yes. That's what we're talking about.
CTE. Too many acronyms.
I know, right?
We should have a playbook.
I know.
So that was two of the big priorities. Those were the two that we really, really focused on. That from the House version, the Senate, I'm not sure what they laid out as their agenda bills. So those priorities that the speaker talks about or the president pro tem talk about, those are typically agenda bills. And normally you'll see about 10 from each chamber. This year we really tried to condense it and focus on maybe five things that were really important to us.
And so
those
so
were the two.
What were, if there were any, most contentious or debated pieces of legislation in this last session?
Oh, boy. The anti-Semitism bill.
What was the bill then?
So giving a clear definition, I think 26 other states have done this ahead of us, and it's using the same definition that the national Jewish community uses to define what anti-Semitism is.
Okay.
And so to put that into statute so that we could implement that throughout all of the schools, K through 12, and higher education, and this is our definition, this is our standard, and here's anti-Semitism.
It's really interesting, right? Because if you're a linguist, you understand that words matter, and so if we're gonna say something is anti-Semitism or something is racism or something, we need to define what those terms are.
Exactly.
Right? And so this was
this is exactly what that did.
What this was.
Yeah. But it was pretty controversial.
It was okay, just because nobody could agree what the definition was?
Well, when it got to the Senate, that's what happened with it, right? They changed the definition. This was a special bill that we had done. Representative Jeter had carried the same bill in 23, and the Senate killed it. They didn't even give it a hearing. So we brought it back again as a priority bill. This is something that the Republican caucus in the House felt very strongly about. The Senate felt very strongly about. We just couldn't come to terms on what that definition should be. They changed the definition in the Senate. We found what we thought could be something that we could live with in the House, and we did the concurrence motion, and we found that happy ground. Now, this is the only bill that the governor vetoed this year. So he did veto it because he wanted the definition that we started with.
Okay. So it wasn't that he was against the bill in general.
It was the definition.
It was he didn't like the definition it ended up with.
Yeah. So, I mean, and he had a lot of good reason for it, too. Why would Indiana want to have a different definition?
28 other states that have
exactly.
Or whatever.
Plus the national community, the national Jewish community. This is what they define it as. So shouldn't we all be using the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with him doing that, and I'm sure that's something we're going to come back and fix.
So you expect next year this to be a topic again?
It will be. It will be. And then we had, I mentioned the third grade learning problem.
Was that contentious? Or?
We didn't have a whole lot of people there to, like, protest it, but it was very contentious between legislators, right? What is the best policy? Should you hold a third grader back because they can't hit this specific level of reading capabilities?
And does it punish some more of our schools that are in maybe economic disadvantaged communities, right?
Well,
so do you have a state standard, or do you have, like, I mean, right, most legislation, right, is legislation that is good that needs nuance sometimes, right?
Right.
So how do you plan the nuance into legislation for a diverse state community?
True. So, I mean, it's really... it's really uniform at you shall read at this level, before you get out of third grade. So the contentious part really came in, and it's, I don't see it as a punishment to any school. It just says you need to read at this level. And if you can't read at that level, then no longer is it an option. You're going to take the test a second time. And if you can't hit that level, then we're going to hold you back in third grade for reading again. And it creates
an IEP.
But you
can move up in fourth grade for math, or how
does
that work?
No, you're going to take third grade over again, right? Okay. So math became a part of that because our math scores are not that good at the third grade level either. So third grade reading was what will trigger it, right? So, but then it triggers what's called an IEP, an individual education plan. There could be some dollars attached to that, but this not being a fiscal year, we didn't deal with any of that. We just set a standard and said, you need to read at this level before you can pass on. And that's the part that got contentious between legislators. So nobody wants to hold anybody back in school. You know, you hear the argument of, that's going to put me behind all my friends, right? That's going to give me a black eye in the school. It's going to make me look silly and foolish, like I'm not smart enough. And it really, I don't know that it does that. I would feel worse if we continued to pass somebody on all the way through 12th grade and they couldn't read at a third grade reading level and they get into the real world. That's going to be a problem. I feel bad for that individual that made it through the system that cannot read.
So then does the bill, like you said, does it automatically trigger an IEP if a child is held back?
It will on that second time, yeah. Okay. You'll have to have an IEP to figure out how do we get you
exactly.
up to
speed.
Yeah,
exactly, because there's clearly something wrong with
problem.
The development issues here
and
we need
and it
to
could
address.
Be dyslexia. It could be a lot of different things, but if we don't take the time to identify those through an IEP, we're really doing that child a disservice.
What were some of the bills that you felt most passionate about moving through that maybe you sponsored or, you know, what were you trying to get done personally in this legislative session?
You know, so, I mean, now this will sound crazy, but I work on septic and sewer and water infrastructure legislation every year. I have for the last 5 years. Yeah, infrastructure is real important to me. I mean, you'll see me offer legislation dealing with infrastructure. So even public utilities, I mess around with utility world stuff, BESS storage systems, battery utility scale, lithium ion battery storage, right? I've done some work in that. I was the first one to legislate anything on that in the nation. Other states are considering that as model legislation. Ohio's probably going to pick it up. Michigan's going to pick it up. Tennessee, I know, has looked at it. So we'll see what happens with that. But it actually sets out how do we allow utility scale lithium ion battery storages to exist? Where can they be? What are the safety parameters?
So these are storages, let's say, from solar fields or something like
that.
It
could be solar. It could be just connected to a transmission point, right? It doesn't even have to have solar connected to it whatsoever. So lithium ion batteries are used throughout the country, and they are of pretty good size, right? So you could have a 100-megawatt facility, you could have a 3-megawatt facility, and you could have a 700-megawatt facility. So to give you some idea of scale, Wheatfield produces about 1,500 megawatts per day. That's what they generate per day. So you could have utility-scale batteries that are holding half of everything that one generation plant has, right? They use that to offset the load on the grid. So if we take it in the middle of the night and we fill up all these batteries, and then during the day we have 110 degree weather and everybody's running their air conditioner, right? We have a peak demand, but we don't have the generation capacity to fire up all these plants and produce the needed amount of electric, so we can put the battery power then into the grid.
Yeah, because I think everyone or every state when a couple of years ago when Texas went through that power crisis, I think it woke everyone up to say,
absolutely,
you know, we need to make sure that we have these contingencies, correct?
We did. And it should be, you know, in the utility world, it needs to look like a diversification, like your investment portfolio, like your 401k, not one particular source of energy or one set of batteries is going to fix all your problems, right? You need to have a little bit of gas. You need to have a little bit of coal. You need to have a little bit of battery. You need to have a little bit of solar. So it's all diversified. Mm-hmm. So when some are generating more and some are generating less, you can power up what we need to power up so that when the air conditioner needs to turn on, it will turn on.
Yeah, I do want to get to a little bit, I guess it kind of triggered a thought, because obviously we have some projects here in LaPorte County and in this area that are solar projects. And we have some people protesting it because they don't like the idea of solar and they don't want farmland to be used for solar. Even though what always gets me about this is, as my father was a developer, these kind of things, if the landowner is willing to do it and the seller is willing to do it and there's guidelines and guardrails for how it should be done, I just get really nervous with the government getting too involved here. But is there state standards for types of solar projects? Or because right now it's kind of going through the county standard.
Yeah, it's done at the local level.
Yeah, and so is there talk of having a state standard, or is that something that for energy anyway that the state still wants to continue to be a county?
Interestingly enough, before solar was a buzzword and upset a lot of people and on either sides of the issue, it just upsets.
Which happens sometimes with issues, right?
It does.
It wasn't a partisan issue, and then something happened.
Something happened, and now it's a problem.
Yep.
So it was about 3 years ago. Ed Soliday, Representative Soliday, that chairs utilities. He's representative over here in Valpo. Extremely intelligent guy. Knows the utility world inside and out. He actually had drafted a piece of legislation that would create a statewide siting plan for solar and for wind. And kind of gave it a baseline of here's what the requirements at minimum should be.
And then each county can add to that.
You can add to it. You can adopt it as is. But we should have this as a minimum, right? Pretty much, I wouldn't say all 92 counties, but I would say 80% of them pushed back and said, no. We don't want this. We will decide locally what's best for us in this issue. So the bill died. And fast forward 3 years, here we are. And I get lots of calls and lots of questions about, well, what is the state standard? And when is the state going to step in and do something with this? And my response is exactly what I've just said. You know, we tried, we brought it forward, but the majority of the counties wanted to handle that county by county as a local issue, and now they're reaching out for help because now it's a reality. It's coming to all different counties. It's not LaPorte County. It's not just Stark County. It's everywhere in the state of Indiana.
Stark County obviously has one of the largest, is getting one of the largest solar projects.
Yeah, that'll be like 13 or 14,000 acres when it's completed. At one point, that was going to be the largest solar operation in the country.
Yeah, and then I think Carlisle, I think, has a somewhat substantial solar field coming as well.
They do, and they have one over in St. Joe County. It's owned by AEP or I&M, which is probably, I think it's like 3 years old, and it's pretty good size, too. It's I want to say it's like 200-300 acres.
Yeah, not as big as Stark County. But the energy companies, NIPSCO, is also, as you talk about, the need for diversification.
Sure.
The energy companies are also talking about diversification, right, to make sure that they're—
Absolutely.
Their profit model is not coming just from one form of energy.
Well, and I think it's profit aside. So profit's one issue, rates are another issue, but generation is the big issue, right?
Sure.
So as you talk about, Michigan City is going to go offline. Wheatfield is supposedly going to go offline. I&M or AEP, their facility, their coal facility in southern Indiana, and Rockport, is scheduled to go offline. And Cook Nuclear is scheduled to go offline.
I didn't know that.
They are. So they have not made a definitive decision on the nuclear facility because of all of the infrastructure needs for, not only Indiana, but MISO and PJM, the Midwest and the Eastern Stock Exchange for power. Mm-hmm. There's no good way to replace this generation, right? So if you're going to take off 1,700 or 1,500 megawatt hours of generation, and you're going to shut it down, what do you replace it with?
Yeah.
People want to buy from the grid, but it takes people generating power to put onto the grid.
To put into the grid, right?
In order to get something out of it. So, it's a fine line right now how do you replace that generation?
Yeah, that's the question is, you just mentioned all of these generation plants that could be closing in the near future. We obviously have timelines for some of those.
We do.
What is Indiana going to do? Or is that why there's such a big movement towards solar?
Solar is a big movement. It's not the end-all, be-all.
Sure.
It is not going to cure the problem. BESS facilities are going to be a part of the solution. Solar can be a part of the solution. gas peaker plants can be a part of that solution. Small nuclear reactors can be a part of that solution, but they all take time. They take a lot of time. Now, Indiana is experiencing economic development growth. We are the fastest growing state population-wise, and it's not a big number, but we are the fastest population growth in the Midwest right now. And I think we've got something like $52 billion worth of economic development investment coming to Indiana over the last 3, maybe 4 years. So some of the projects just in our area, when you talked about, you know, what may happen here in LaPorte and what the time frame is, I don't know on that. But what's going to happen in LaPorte, the New Carlisle, two facilities over there, and then another facility in Mishawaka. Four facilities will take the power from AEP 100% what they generate today. Four projects. How do you replace that? Now we're not taking anything offline. We're just added demand.
Yeah, and that is the hard thing too, is as they say, we're going to need more power as we have more, you know, electric vehicles, as we, you know, we
sure
as we use more air conditioning, as we, you know, all these things, we need the generation of power, because as consumers, we're wanting more power stuff.
Mm-hmm. More generation, and then we need more transmission lines to make that a reality also. So you've seen a lot in our area, added generation lines. AEP just went through and did a bunch. NIPSCO's done a bunch. But we need more to be able to distribute the more of that energy, right? So it's a complicated problem that's coming up very fast. So to do a nuclear facility or even to renew Cook could take 8 years of regulatory paperwork to get that done. And it's a nuclear facility. Should it take that long? Mm-hmm. Should it not? They have a life expectancy.
Because nuclear also generates a ton of power in that little footprint, right?
It absolutely does. Small nuclear reactors. I mean, to get from we're going to do this project. We've got IURC to approve it because they have to approve it. Because of the ratepayer, right? Yeah. We want to make sure that the utilities are held accountable and don't just spend all kinds of money, because they have what's called recoverables, right? So they're allowed to recover their expenses plus a 10% profit margin. That's it. So we don't want them just spending on things to generate more 10% profit margin, mm-hmm. right? So that we got to be careful how many of those we let out. But if you go through that whole process, I mean, you could be 6 years on a natural gas peaker plant to be able to supply that additional power when the demand is there. So you can turn those up and turn them down relatively quickly, but it doesn't happen like in 10 minutes, right? So you got to build them up.
So let's move on a little bit to roads, because I know that is you chair that committee. It is an important part of what you do. Also, this is a LaPorte-based podcast sponsored by the LaPorte Economic Advancement Partnership. And obviously economic development and roads, all these kind of things locally have been a conversation that goes sure. hand in glove. We talk about money needed for an economic corridor, as we talked about in the north-south corridor that would potentially bypass around LaPorte. Now that's been reworked a little bit to maybe even come in LaPorte. We also, if you spend any time on the internet, you see in the groups people complaining about potholes and sidewalks sure. are failing and things like this. What do you think is the current state of infrastructure, especially as it relates to road infrastructure in Indiana? And what do you see as the primary challenges moving forward?
You know, so, and I get asked that quite a bit, so that's a great question. So in 2023 and in 2022, Indiana was the rated number one, I believe, by CNBC for infrastructure in the nation. And doesn't mean we had the best roads, but we had the best plan moving forward to take care of those roads. And it was all based on maintenance, preventive maintenance, P&M. We're in really good shape compared to other states. And we're paying for that as we go, which is gets us that number one rating, right? Mm-hmm. We are not bonding all these projects. We're not borrowing my grandchildren's inheritance. We're not borrowing their future earnings to pay for roads for today. We're actually paying for the roads as we go. And I think that's important. And that's what gets us up there in that number one. Can we do better? Absolutely, we can do better. And we're going to have to do better because of the inflationary costs of the projects themselves have gone from in a 5-year scenario. So NDOT, just on the state level, we'll start 5 years, like right now in 2024, NDOT is making the 29 and 2030 plans. These are the improvements that we want. This is
new roads that need to be
built. Done. Well, we're not even talking about new roads. We're talking about taking care of what we've got now and finishing what we started.
And that's a 5-year.
That's a 5-year look, right? So we're going to base those projects on today's price. And then we're going to put in a little bit of an you know, maybe a 2% as it goes.
What would be a typical inflation?
Yeah, it's the engineer's cost until we get to that date when it goes to let. And then we're going to put a firm number on it. Well, what we've seen post-COVID is about a 30 to 40% increase in those projects. And you'll see that locally. I hear it from mayors. I hear it from county commissioners all across the state. And that number is still the same. It's between 30 and 40%, depending on the project. Bridges are more, roads are a little bit less. So how do we improve upon that? And, you know, some would argue the gas tax is too high. Let's get rid of the gas tax. But what you need to know, the importance of that is everything that gets paid for at the pump, 100%, goes into road funding locally and the state level. Nothing comes out of the general fund, which means your income taxes that you're paying, your sales tax that you're paying on anything other than gas is not going into the roads, right? Only what you pay for at the pump. That's how we fund it. It's a user-based system. So what does the model into the future look like when you start thinking about hybrid vehicles, CAFE standards, EVs, and I would tell you, EVs are not the problem right now. I mean, it's such a small number.
I hear this often, but you're absolutely right.
People want to talk about it, but it is such a very small number. There are less than 12,000 totally plug-in BEVs in the state of Indiana registered right now. That's it.
And as you've mentioned
like
before to me,
million.
Off, they are also, they're charged for it, correct?
Oh, they are. They do. They pay for it in the form of a registration fee. They pay an additional $222. That is indexed, and it's indexed according to the previous year's gas tax that the average combustion engine driver paid, right?
Yeah, so the idea that an EV isn't paying for their roads, they are contributing because they have to.
They do. What's interesting is those dollars, I don't mean to get sidetracked, but those dollars go into what we call community crossings. CCMG is what you'll hear locals talk about all the time, and that's the match program between the city of LaPorte and the county of LaPorte with the state to apply for $1 million of matching dollars. So they can really leverage the local tax dollars. If they're going to put up $500,000, the state will give you $1 million. We'll double it. You got to put 50% in. So if you do, or where we're at now is we went to, in January's call, I think we went from $1 million to $1.5 million. So all of the registration fee for EVs, total plug-ins, and hybrids go into community crossings. That's what funds it. Now, that's up to about $200 million a year that come directly back to locals to fix your local streets and allowing you to leverage getting a 2-for-1, basically, on those dollars.
Yeah, and I don't think a lot of people understand because we've talked about this. We had Craig Phillips and Nick Minnick on our first episode, but just the how funding happens and that your funding is a partnership between your local government and your state government. Now, the state, like you said, puts in 2/3 in the local government, your municipality will put in 1/3, but it is it's an equation for the funding for your roads.
Yeah, it's a way for them to leverage it, right, to address needs that they wouldn't be able to do on their own, to pick those projects where they need to do more road miles or do a bridge. So during the interim, one of my tasks that I'm assigned to is the first task force that will be doing a deep dive into the future of how do we collect road funding? What does road funding look like in the future? As all of these things are taking place, everything that's going on and the need for added capacity. I mean, we talked a little bit about, and I kind of cautioned you, or I corrected you maybe, and said, that's not for new roads. That's that's to pay for what we already have in place. So we need to talk about
to relate that to LaPorte. Obviously, when we talk about the corridor, that is a new road project.
Brand new road, right? We do not have the dollars for that. We've never planned for that, right? Added capacity.
That's never
going to
be in the budget then the NDOT budget anyway.
Nope, we will not put it in the NDOT budget, and we will definitely, well, let me go backwards. We will put it in an NDOT budget because we see the need as a state for added capacity.
Yeah, projects. But it's not going to be in their planning, let's say.
It is not.
And so you're going to have to, in your funding years, in your funding sessions, to decide whether
figure
or not
this out.
It's worth funding.
Yeah, and to figure out, you know, how do we pay for it going forward, right? So you want to, in my mind, part of my job is to play a longer game, you know, not just, okay, be reactive and react to the needs that we need in 6 months or a year, but we need to be thinking out into the future. We need to be talking about 30 years out in advance and then dial in a little closer on 20 years in advance.
Which has to be a little bit predictive, right? Because you don't know how much EVs are going to be a part of it. You don't know how we're going to use our roads. You don't know if fewer or if more people are working from home and less people are on the roads and, you know, all these kind of things, right?
That's it. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head, you know, and think about, and a lot of folks won't even really consider this, but, you know, how often does your cell phone change? Do we get new technology like every hour on the hour for our phones, for our laptops? You'll never have the latest and greatest piece of technology. Batteries in the EVs are no different, right? That technology continues to change. And as it evolves, one of the things that's really predominant right now, Toyota has the technology. A couple other manufacturers have the technology, but Toyota's on the forefront of this. A solid-state battery. And the solid-state battery weighs less than the traditional lithium-ion battery. And it has a distance, a miles distance of 750 miles.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And it gets better, right? It'll go from 20% of a charge. So you run it down to 20%. It'll charge all the way up to 80% on a 110 charger in about 15 minutes.
That's nuts.
That's a game changer. So you got to think about how that technology is going to change. Now, can they mass produce it? Great question. They're trying to mass produce it now. Does it make it? But I guess my point is technologies will change.
Yeah, whether that's the technology that gets adopted or there's a couple more adaptions before then,
sure,
that is coming, right? I mean,
it's coming. It's a changing world. And we don't talk too much about hydrogen. Hydrogen is something that I would keep my eye on for heavier equipment, for tractor trailers, right? Hydrogen is really a thing. Locomotives, you're never going to power those by electric.
But there might be another energy source, right?
Cummins is working at hydrogen technology.
I want to talk, I guess, specifically about the infrastructure project that the city wants to do or continues to talk about. Let's just talk about the need of it, not the specifics. Do you, as a legislator, as you hear from the mayor, as you hear from the city engineer or the city planner, do those concerns resonate with you that there's maybe the city needs more traffic to go around the downtown instead of through the downtown? Obviously, we can talk about the plans. That's a bigger hurdle, but does the need resonate with you?
Absolutely, it does. You know, that's part of what you do as a legislator, or what you should be doing as a legislator is really paying attention to what local communities are telling you. Constituents are telling you this. Your elected officials that are closest to those issues are telling you this. And then, honestly, as all you need to do is look around after somebody's telling you that and go, is there a need to get rid of traffic, right? Can I see the possibility? Could anyone see the possibility if you were to reduce the traffic by 50%? What does that mean for a downtown? You know, and take LaPorte out of the equation. It could be anywhere.
Because I'm sure there's other cities in the state that are
absolutely
also working
they're in very similar circumstances, trying to do upgrades to their city, but they can't because of the traffic, right? Or the congestion, or maybe it was just planned poorly. Yep. Yep. So you look at 30 in the Propel project in Columbia City, and when I drive 30 and all those stoplights over there and all the traffic that it accumulates, I get why they want to do something different there, run a bypass around it, maybe create a frontage road to eliminate those stoplights to make that traffic move more freely. Makes sense. So you got to pay attention to what they're telling you, and then try to work with them on a scenario on how can this be beneficial? Is it beneficial? And then you hear those projects that somebody will tell you they absolutely have to have, and it's a wish list, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to focus, I think, on the ones that are really a priority now.
Well, I've taken up a lot of your time. If as we've talked about how legislation is formed, as we've talked about how you take in, if somebody has an idea for legislation, because again, there's been a legislation. You know, I think it's really interesting that, you know, in the work that I do with food insecurity and food work 15 years ago, hobby farms weren't as big as they are now. And we get contacted, for instance, about people that have chickens and they're growing chickens. And they want to donate those eggs because they've got... And before, right, typically you cannot donate something you make or create at home to a food pantry that's handed out because of different laws. And there's been legislation to correct these things. People don't understand that oftentimes there's a need that arises, even recently, and legislation needs to respond to that need.
Exactly.
So if somebody's listening, they've got an idea or something, and they want to talk to you about either legislation or something going on in their community, how do they get a hold of you, and what's that process like?
You know, so I would say the best bet is just to call me on my cell phone. It's 219-608-9927. I will respond. Sometimes it takes me a couple of days to get back to you. You know this. Mm-hmm. you can shoot me a text, and we can set up something to where we can jump on a call together. We can grab a cup of coffee, you know, depending on time constraints, and have a conversation about what you're thinking. Or you can email me at h20@in.gov. That will get to me. Or you can use a quicker email that'll get to me that I know a lot better is jimpressel20@gmail.com. So I try to keep them in those, the different ones. My legislative assistant will get the H20 account. I'll see those periodically, but constituent cases we try and run through there so he can keep track of what's going on in the agencies. But yeah, feel free to reach out to me anytime.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the Plugged In LaPorte podcast. Hope to have you back again soon.
I love it. Great experience.
All right. It's time to go on an engaging and enlightening journey into the world of green spaces, recreation, and community involvement right here in LaPorte. In a segment that will become a monthly feature, we're going to be delving deep into the heart of our city's Parks and Recreation Department. And who better to guide us through the trails, the grassy expanses, and developmental programs than the man in charge of these efforts, the superintendent of the LaPorte Parks and Recreation Department, Mark Schreiber. Together, we're going to explore the latest updates that our community should be excited about, including maybe even new trails, the creation of parks, information on youth sports signups, and various opportunities for our listeners to get involved. Mark, it is an absolute pleasure to have you with us. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, I appreciate the invitation. Anytime I have the opportunity to get some information about Parks and Rec out there, happy to be here.
And is it fair to say you are the Leslie Knope of LaPorte?
I would actually be the Ron Swanson if you were to go by the actual characters. Well, just the role they played. Ron was the park superintendent.
That is true.
Leslie was, I believe, probably the assistant director or something along those lines. But I would probably be a split between the two, right? Kind of down the middle. I've got a little bit of Ron in me, probably definitely some of Leslie. Not so much of some of the other characters, but yeah.
So you've been the parks superintendent for how long now?
I'm in my 10th year. It was June of 2014. I was appointed by Mayor Blair Milo. And then I've been retained by Mayor Krentz and Mayor Dermody.
Now, you are a friend of mine. I'm going to say you've aged some, all right? And I think the stresses of this Parks Department is getting to you because you guys do so much stuff. It is a ton. I don't know if our community necessarily realizes how busy the Parks Department is here in LaPorte.
Yeah, I don't think sometimes people realize the scope of the Park Department. And you know, the 16 parks, yes, but it's also the Civic Auditorium, it's Beechwood Golf Course, it's the now the Senior Center, the Activity Center for Older Adults. You know, we have a burgeoning trail system, and we've had a lot of projects. So, you know, people used to always say, "Well, what do you guys do in the off season?" And I always had an answer for it because there's always planning, there's always things to be done. My answer now is we don't have an off season. Nope. We really do go year round with everything we do, and that goes for all of our facilities. You know, even Beechwood that has to shut down for a time when the snow flies. There's still work being done out there to make sure we're ready to go. So, all of our facilities, everything we're working on, it's a 365 day a year job.
And busier now than it was 10 years ago, correct?
Oh, by far. And that's a good thing. There's this organization that was formed back around 2017 called the Health Foundation of LaPorte, and they've kept me pretty busy. They've been very generous with their dollars. They've allowed us to do projects that otherwise, would have taken years to do rather than months to do because we would have been looking for federal grants, state grants, looking for these monies in a lot of different places. They've been either been able to provide full funding for projects or matches where we needed matches. And they've allowed us to really put the acceleration on infrastructure. important infrastructure, things that we were behind on, trails primarily being one of them. You know, I would go to these meetings over at NERPC and talking about putting in trails and this and that, and people are talking about connections and the, even, you know, boy, we've got to renovate this trail because they'd had trails for 20, 30 years. We were building our first trail. We opened our first trail, a multi-use trail, in 2019, and we've gone gangbusters since, and we've got a lot of great things on the planning books, but we're catching up to where other communities around our state have been for a long time, really around our nation.
What is really fascinating about that is I'm also guessing the people that you talk to in other cities would really kill for the wildlife and the parks-like infrastructure we have naturally in the city, correct? Like the lakes.
Oh, absolutely. You know. I mean, our natural resources are our strength. We've just have to continue to enhance them, bring people to them. Just having lakes alone, that doesn't do it. You have to bring people to the water, bring people to the lakes, and to the amenities that we're able to build. I've heard the mayor from Carmel speak a couple different times at park functions, and he talks about how big their budget is for parks. Well, first of all, they have that money. But secondly, he says we have to do that because we don't have the natural resources that some of you have. We have to create what we don't have naturally. And in La Porte, we have it naturally. We just need to enhance it, take advantage of it, and hopefully that's the direction that we've been going.
And have a strategy for it too, right?
Have a strategy for it. You know, people for years have always said, well, we don't take advantage of our lakes enough. Well, we think that we're starting to do that. You know, whether it be the Stone Lake Trail, the Loop Trail around Clear Lake, the enhancements we're making to Fox Park, we've been putting money in annually to Stone Lake Beach. We just worked with the DNR to get the boat launch at Stone Lake revamped, and we're doing more there. So we really feel like, you know, we want to get our residents to water. I grew up on 10th Street. I didn't grow up on water. I went to Clark Park all summer. We went to Beach Fun Day. It's probably one of the only times I ever went to Stone Lake Beach. I wasn't out on the lakes. So we want everybody, hey, if you live south of Lincoln Way, these are still your lakes. Let's get you out on them. Let's find amenities. Let's find ways to get you engaged with the natural resources we do have.
So let's talk a little bit. We're going to get into some of the programs that people need to know about coming up, but also let's talk about some updates because you do operate. You don't always design, but I know you have a hand in that. Obviously,
sure.
This is Craig and Nick and other people at the team are part of this.
Sure.
But once it's done, it's yours.
You know? No, absolutely. So, the maintenance, right, yep. and the operation and the programming of these amenities, that's when it really does take over for us. But I always play a hand. They always allow us to have some say. Our master plan feeds in the Stone Lake, the Soldiers Memorial Park master plan feeds in, the Heart of La Porte plan feeds in. So, we always have a hand in it. But, yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Those become, trails are just lineal parks, right? They're just long parks.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that people can maybe expect to see this spring, this fall, this summer, and this fall.
Yeah.
Clear Lake, obviously, there's a lot of work going to finish the loop that is around Clear Lake. If you've walked the Clear Lake Trail at all before, you know that it ended essentially
sure.
at Truesdale. Now you guys have that are almost completed, and then you're adding a feature that goes into Clear Lake a little bit. Why don't you explain what's happening there and maybe how people can enjoy that here in the future?
Yeah, so a lot of that work started last year, and we really wanted to, and it coincided with the Truesdale reconstruction, but then we also had HFL money to enhance Fox Park. How do we get people engaged with Fox Park? And that includes finishing the loop trail all the way around. You'll be able to walk all the way around.
It was about 2 miles, I think, right?
It's probably about 2 miles all the way around. It's not a 5K. We know we've looked at it before. You got to stretch it out. You got to find a few little ways to maneuver it into a 5K. But it was amazing, you know, that work was being done last year. The trail wasn't even paved yet. There were heavy machinery, big trucks going up and down Truesdale, and I'd see a mother pushing a baby stroller down where the trail goes, where they'd carved the path for it. People craved wanting to go around and walk that lake so much that they were out there before we even got it paved or anything, and it's still not done because we are still working on the plaza area, which will be right across from the Dennis F. Smith Amphitheater, and that plaza area is going to be a nice enhancement in that it gives people a place for passive recreation, a place to meet up with friends before a concert, a place to have a picnic
tables and stuff like that.
Right, exactly. It's going to bring people closer to the water. Now, let's be completely honest. We understand the score on Clear Lake. We understand that there's PCBs in the sediment there, but they're in the sediment at the bottom of the lake bed. PCBs don't jump through water. They're not going to go out and bite you on the ankles as you're walking by. The trails are perfectly safe. This plaza is perfectly safe. There's nothing we're doing out there that is disingenuous to what we know. And we know what the public knows. We know what IDEM knows. They tell us, we tell the public. We've been very upfront. Hey, catch and release or follow IDEM's restrictions on fishing out there. It's pretty simple. But I can tell you this much. I have talked to DNR and they have told me numerous times, most towns would kill to have a clear lake. Mm-hmm. A lake like that right off their downtown, something, a nice amenity. Now, we understand the industrial past has been bad to the lake. But that doesn't mean you can't be out recreating around the lake. And that's something that draws people out. It is a positive. Fox Park is a positive. That trail is a positive, and we're just going to continue to enhance them.
So what other things, what other park improvements are you expecting this spring and summer?
Yeah, so we're working to complete two additional legs of the Stone Lake Trail. One of them will go from the beach house where it currently deadens, and it will go past the beach, past Cummings Lodge, through the wooded areas, and then it will go to just short of where the Waverly Bridge is, where the channel is there. And then we're also looking to take it the other direction. We'll take it from Craven all the way out to Orchard Avenue, which most people would refer to as Small Road. Mm-hmm. That's being held up a little bit because we have some well projects going out there with the water department. They're going to be running some well field lines and some things through there, so you don't want to build and then tear up. But that's definitely on the horizon. The Slicer Greenway, which will basically create a walkable, bikeable path from the high school all the way out to the Kessling campus is in the works. So there are a lot of great trail projects we're working on.
When you say in the works, probably this year, hopefully.
Those are all things that are funded. Those are things that are locked and loaded. We just have to get the projects off the ground. Then we have something as grand as the Chessie 3 project, which is basically take the Chessie Trail. Now, those of you that know the Chessie Trail, originally it went from Kiwanis Teledyne Park down the old Chessie Corridor, deadened at the end of Newport Landing. Now we've taken it past Lily Lake, down Tyler Street, down First Street. It goes all the way out to the transport building. Chessie 3 is a lot more ambitious. We're talking about going north and connecting LaPorte to Michigan City. It's got a big price tag on it. It'll probably be done in phases because of that. But it really is a big project for us in that it will make us bikeable as a county from our county seat all the way up to Michigan City. The great thing about connecting to Michigan City is then you can connect into the Marquette Greenway, which is a series of trails that go from Chicago all the way to New Buffalo. You'll be able to ride your bike to Michigan City. You could either get on the South Shore. They allow you to put bikes on the train. You could train up to Chicago, or you could jump on that. And if you're ambitious enough, ride all the way to Chicago, right up into Michigan. It's connectivity, and it's something that, again, I believe that younger potential residents are looking for in their community is that type of trail connectivity.
I think a lot of people think because something is not for them or something that they don't enjoy that no one will enjoy that thing. And I'm right. You know, I hear online sometimes this fodder that nobody goes to the Stone Lake Trail. As somebody that used to live over there, I don't anymore, but I used to see people there literally all the time.
Correct.
Walking dogs and not always living in that area. There are people that would park there and then just use that area because Stone Lake is such a beautiful lake that you're looking to get out, you know? And so I think, and I want to caution any of our listeners, don't get caught up just because this program is not for you or this trail or this park isn't for you doesn't mean it's not for someone.
No, absolutely. I think one of the greater challenges in parks and recreation is the diversity of park and recreations, the diversity in interests. There's some people who are avid golfers. They'd like to see all of our money go to Beechwood. There are people who love Arts in the Park concerts. Put more into the amphitheater.
You guys even do pottery stuff, correct?
Sure. We have all kinds of enrichment classes, exercise wellness classes that we offer. And obviously, you know, we've always been in the youth sports, adult sports business. But there's such a diversity of what people really enjoy. And, you know, trying to touch on all of those and enhance all of those elements, all of those amenities or all those programs is a great challenge because, again, you know, look at something burgeoning like pickleball. I mean, they're rabid, and that's a great thing because
I made a rule to myself. Yeah. Don't get in a fight with a pickleball player because they are passionate people.
They are very passionate, and it's a good thing. They take ownership of it. They love it. You know what the great thing is? You go out there If you've got a racket, they're gonna. Maybe you don't even bring a racket. They'll show you how to play.
Somebody's
gonna pull you in, and they're gonna show you how to play. It's grown organically. We offered a couple clinics when we first put in the dedicated courts. We don't need to do that because all you have to do is show up. They're gonna bring you in. They want you to be a pickleball player like them. We will be building more pickleball courts soon. Matter of fact, when we renovated those courts out at Kessling, we had to keep the tennis course because we have a tennis program and we have the need for that.
As a tennis player, I'm grateful.
And the middle school uses it. But the one thing that the contractor told me going into it, he said, the only thing you're going to regret about this project is you're not putting in more pickleball courts. Mm-hmm. And he was right, because we'll be putting more in soon. But it's a great example of a group in our community that is passionate about what they do. They want to see it grow, and they want to see the dollars allocated there, right? So maybe they're not going to be as on board for renovating the ball diamonds. They want to see pickleball done. They may not be as excited about a renovation at Beechwood, but because they want to see pickleball. And I'm not picking on them. They're just passionate about what they do. And the same would be true of almost any other group in their passion. So you do see a lot of people who don't understand trails. They don't believe in it. Frankly, that's why LaPorte's behind in the first place. One of my predecessors way back, Dean Heiss, promoted a trail program, and it was completely shot down for funding because the thought was, well, if we can't pave every single road, we're not going to put a single trail in until that happens. Well, that was not very forward thinking. It wasn't looking to what people want in their community, and maybe one of those reasons why we've been stagnated.
All right, we're going to get to the programs, but this anecdote for you real quick, because I think it's really important for listeners to hear. So my daughter and I love going to Kessling to play tennis, and they're great tennis courts too. Met somebody there last year. Three times I saw this family there, and they were from South Bend, and they come over to play pickleball here in LaPorte because they said it is known as the nicest pickleball courts in the area. And they said, plus, we just love the setting out here. So a young family coming from South Bend to LaPorte to participate. Obviously, we can get into, they're not paying the taxes, these kind of things, but that's how beautiful our facilities are, and that there are people that are willing to drive 20 miles just to get to these courts because they found, A, the people that are playing pickleball here are genuinely enjoying the pickleball experience, but B, it's a great place to bring your kids as well. So kudos to you. You guys have done a great job with all of that.
Absolutely. And you could sub my mountain bike trail in for pickleball court. You could sub ball diamonds. I mean, people like to come to our tournaments. We don't have the fanciest baseball complex out there. You know, we have four diamonds. We don't have lights. But people love to come to tournaments in LaPorte because Fort LaPlayport's right down the road. Mm-hmm. There's a walking trail right there for the parents who maybe between games want to walk. Mm-hmm. There's trees. There's grass. It's a beautiful setting. It's not a concrete setting. But you could sub in a lot of those things. There's people who love Stone Lake Beach from out of town. What amazing beach to have in your town. Mm-hmm. People from LaPorte are like, you know, I'm going to New Buffalo. I'm going to Washington Park.
I would also encourage people to give Stone Lake Beach another try if you haven't in the last 10 years. It is much nicer than it used to be when I was a kid in the 80s and 90s.
And a lot of people have. The pandemic had a lot of negative results about it. But one of the positive things that came out of it is we rediscovered local, right? We rediscovered what's in our own backyard. And I would say Stone Lake Beach is one of the better family beaches you're ever going to find. I know I would feel much more comfortable taking my children who are under the age of 11 or 10 to Stone Lake Beach rather than take them up to Washington Park, where you might have to deal with undertow, and you certainly don't lose track of your kid for 1 second. I used to work at the YMCA. We used to take kids on field trips up there. I was a ball, wound up tight the whole time because you can only go into your ankles. You can only go in this far. Stone Lake Beach is a much more, obviously, calmer setting. It's a much more family setting. And we have, with the help of HFL and the Park Foundation and other funders, been able to enhance the beach more. We have the kayak infrastructure there. We now have some ping pong table, cornhole boards. We're going to go further to activate those with some kiosks where you can actually download and open up the lockers and get some ping pong battles and balls out, get some bags out and play. We just keep trying to push it a little bit more to make it a little bit nicer every year because post-pandemic, it's a priority, and getting people to water is a big thing to us.
All right, so in our just brief couple of minutes, this episode is going to come out in April, where we are recording it in March for those of our listeners. Get a little inside baseball for you. But for those that are parents thinking about signing kids up for stuff in the summer, what do you have to offer, all of those, and maybe even adults, but what kinds of things can people start looking to get signed up for?
Yeah, I mean, obviously our youth baseball and softball leagues, when we get to this point, though, to be honest, we're already in organizing it. It's We've got our rally days, which are our day where the parents and kids come and find out what team they're on. For some of our older divisions, that's this Saturday. So sometimes we do get that call when the weather turns real nice late April. They're like, oh, gosh, I forgot about baseball. We can still get kids in.
So still call. Right?
Still call. Still, we can still get some kids in. But we're still taking signups for T-ball. We're still taking signups for tennis. And, you know, obviously we'll have our summer playground program, which is a free program that'll be out in five parks this summer. We'll have a nature camp, our art camp that we've had for decades that is not just a arts and crafts camp. It is a true arts camp, a great experience for the kids at Cummings Lodge. So we have a lot of things for kids out there, and we have a lot of great things for adults as well. So encourage people to go to our website, laporteparkandrec.com, dig into it. But one of the great things about LaPorte is we all work well as partners, whether it's the YMCA, the library, all the other providers of things that are out there in the community. Dig in and find what's out there, because LaPorte really does have a lot. And I'll say this much too. I mean, the number of events we do, whether it's on a grander scale like Lake Fest, the one-offs like the Friday Night Lives, movie nights, there are so many things to do in LaPorte now. One of the things Mayor Dermody said I never want to hear somebody say is there's nothing to do in LaPorte. Well, if you're saying that, maybe it's just because you haven't discovered those things yet, because there certainly is a lot to do.
Well, thanks so much, Mark. And again, I want to encourage you, if you're a parent and you want your kids to participate in something, or just kind of get, you know, whether or not, let's put them in tennis camp to see if they like tennis. Let's put them in all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. Look at the LaPorte Parks and Rec's website, and you're going to find something, probably multiple things for your kids to participate in that yep. is affordable and accessible to you and your family.
Yeah, I've always been asked that. Well, what should I get my kid involved in? Let them try a little bit of everything. Yeah. I would tell them the most important thing to do is learn how to swim, right? We have a lot of big lakes around here. Put them in swim lessons. Let them gravitate to what they want to. And, you know, don't push, but let them explore.
Well, Mark, I'm grateful for you. We'll have you back again next month. We'll talk about some more stuff then. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. Have a great day. And with that, we have reached the end of our fourth episode of the Plugged in LaPorte podcast. Today's journey has been quite enlightening as we delved into the heart of our community with our esteemed guests. State Representative Jim Pressel, LaPorte Park Superintendent Mark Schreiber. Their perspectives have shed light on the various facets of living and working in LaPorte, Indiana, with its unique charm and challenges. A special thank you goes out to our podcast partner, the LaPorte Economic Advancement Partnership, for making this conversation possible. To learn more about their incredible work in the city of LaPorte and economic development specifically, and how they are shaping the future of this city, please visit laportepartnership.com. Now, if today's episode has sparked your curiosity or deepened your connection to our community, we would be thrilled if you would take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review the Plugged in LaPorte podcast on your preferred listening platform. Your feedback not only helps us improve, but also allows us to reach more listeners who, like you, are eager to get curious, connected, and plugged in. Remember, each of us plays a vital role in creating a strong community. By staying informed, engaged, and supportive of one another, there's no limit to what we can achieve together in this city. Until next time, let's keep the conversations going. Stay connected and get plugged in. This is your host, Nate Lauch, signing off.